Hello, this is Raymond, and you are listening to Global Yard.
Global Yard. Global Yard. Global Yard.
Welcome to the Global Yardy Podcast. Global Yardy. Global Yardy captured colorful and powerful conversations on climate, culture, and sustainability.
Hello, this is Sammy from Nigeria. It's good to have Global Yardy back.
Global Yardy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Yardy podcast. I'm your host, Dana Lynn. If you are new to this podcast, thanks for tuning in. And if you are a returning listener, thank you for your continued support and staying with us for another season. Now, I don't do this enough or as often as I should, so I'm encouraging you all. We are on social media. Follow us at Global Yardy on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I think we kind of hang out more on Instagram, though. And feel free to check out our website at globalyardy.com. And please give us a follow or rate us on your favorite listening platform. So thank you so much for all that you've been doing listening. But we want to up the engagement this season. We want to hear your feedback. So reach out to us. Let us know what you think about the podcast. Let us know about your recommendations and just keep the community strong. Now, I'm going to start with my usual cliche sentence about having a special guest. Today, we're joined by a very special guest in the Global Yardy guest seat as we dive into the world of Mari culture. And I'm going to let that marinate if you don't know what that means. But I have with me Nicholas Key from Jamaica, and he is the co-founder and CEO of Key Farms, and that's a regenerative ocean farm network that's focused on growing seaweed, oysters, and other oceanic organisms with a view to reduce greenhouse gases and increase biodiversity in the oceanic ecosystem. So that's a very amazing thing, especially loving the innovation that's coming out of Jamaica. Nicholas, welcome to Global Yardy.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I mean, I feel like it's 2 years in the making, or so, because from the minute I saw you come out with Key Farms, I'm like, I have to have you on the Global Yardy podcast. But I guess nothing before its time, Nate, because I mean, I'm sure compared to 2 years ago, a lot has happened. Even if you're still, you know, new or, you know, there's so many developments, but before I even go into Key Farms, we go way back? way back if you're talking 2017, 2018, thereabout, because I knew about you in like business and the tech space, you know, pitch competitions, you know, software development, all of those things. So now you're doing seaweed farming. How did you make that transition?
The transition wasn't, it was a bit intentional. It happened during the pandemic, and before starting this, I was running a tech nonprofit called Next Gen Creators. We had essentially trained youth in the Caribbean how to code, and we would teach them different digital literacy skills. And when the pandemic hit, we did like this last hurrah hackathon throughout the Commonwealth, and that went well. But then I got burnt out afterwards, and I took a break. And to resurface, I was more so in the planning mode of just thinking many decades beyond where I was at the time. And I came to the resolution that I wanted to focus on climate change and finance and technology in a more serious way and a more strategic way. And at the time, I knew that I needed a break from tech, and climate change seemed like the ripest opportunity for me, based on just like past experience in the policy space and past experience in more science-y aspect of like renewable energy tech. And so I was kind of going down the rabbit hole a bit on what could be done in the Caribbean, just like how I'd done so with technology. And so that's how things started to take shape a bit.
Wow, that's an interesting angle, because especially in the quite a pivot, if I may use the most commonly referenced term, you know, that was a buzzword in the pandemic, pivot. And so it's very interesting, because the pandemic was, you know, there was like an acceleration of tech and persons, you know, capitalizing on emerging technologies and all of those things. So it's very interesting that at that point where people were like racing into tech, you're like racing out of it, or like
I really wanted to go outside. That was my aim.
You needed to go outside. So yeah, but why seaweed farming? How did you decide that seaweed farming is where I'm going to venture into? Is what I'm going to venture into?
Yeah. So my objective, or at least my objective outcome, was to look more broadly at impacts that could be had by people within the Caribbean region with respect to climate action. Seaweed farming and ocean farming, by extension, was like one of the major activities that I had brainstormed about. And this was mainly because we had access to the entire Caribbean Sea, and it wasn't really being capitalized on. And the blue economy, especially in the Caribbean, was very sparse. And so whenever there is like lack of activity, that usually means that there is a wealth of opportunity that is very untapped, very much untapped. And so I was more so just like curious about what could be done in this very empty space, to see how I could even contribute to doing something in there.
All right. So like, take us through that. So what did you do to kind of get ready and, you know, to develop a structure to transition in this space with the intention that you really set out to?
Yeah, so the original plan was quite literally just to like grow seaweed. And in charting out on that objective, we hit like, or at least I hit a whole lot of roadblocks along the way. I realized that we needed like a whole lot of permits and licenses. And then when I had come about, you know, trying to break through those barriers, I realized that in many cases, we didn't have some of the permits and even the licenses that we had just generally, or even policies to support the activities that we wanted to do. So it meant that I had to take a step back to kind of work within the policy space a bit. And then once I hit another barrier, which was, you know, kind of scoping out why things weren't being done within the mariculture space in the way that it was being done, I realized that the fisher folk themselves, they were just like a bit left out, and they're vulnerable because the fishing activity was pretty much dead. So I encountered another problem with just having to work with community members or just work with the fisher folk themselves, because there was no opportunity there. And when there is no opportunity present, and you come with something new and innovative as like a potential like new opportunity, if you don't involve the community, then there is prospects for things like predator larceny. So that's how things have like continually evolved over time.
Predator larceny at sea?
Yeah.
I never thought about that.
They call them pirates.
Well, I mean, I guess when I think of pirates, I think about treasure. But like in seaweed, I'm like, people are stealing seaweed? So you mentioned a lot of things that I know we really want to talk about. So we're going to hold off on the policy conversation and before you even get to like access to finance for seaweed. You remember I told everyone that we're letting it marinate, you know, but I know by now they know that mariculture has to do with seaweed. But I guess in a larger context, it's basically like the cultivation of like fish or marine organisms for food and other uses, you know, in a simple way of putting it. But I know I asked you why seaweed farming, and you spoke in general about the environmental benefits, but can you give us some more, you know, examples, like, you know, what are some products, like if you're trying to sell seaweed to Jamaica, because, you know, Jamaicans interested in weed. Now you're putting this is a different kind of weed. So why seaweed? So what does it offer? What are the economic and environment opportunities or benefits to seaweed farming?
Yeah. For us, without getting into the heavy technical details of... Yeah, but what we recognize as, I guess, seaweed is coming in the form of, like, sea moss. And so sea moss is what you probably find in, like, the drinks that we have in Jamaica, so the strong back and... The Irish moss, yeah, which is not really Irish moss, it's really sea moss. Irish moss is like a whole other strain, technically a whole other strain of sea that in Ireland, actually. But in the Caribbean, we have our own variant, which is sea moss. And so you find it in that, right? In your foods, your beverages. If you extract it to create like different value-added products, you'll find it in like your beauty products, your creams, your thickening agents, your toothpaste, everything within the biotechnology realm as well. So you within the petri dishes, use it for different solutions. You can use it in dog food. It just quite covers
smoothies.
Most definitely smoothies and all. So that's like one type of quote unquote seaweed that we actually use or I guess see or experience. The other type that you probably see wash up on the shores, especially in the Caribbean, and in particular Jamaica, is like the sargassum. And so we're trying to use that as well, but you at that stage we kind of in the heavy research and development for creating very eccentric byproducts and value-added products from
that. What are the plans for sargassum?
Yeah, so right now on the books, we're toying around with biodegradable cardboard and for packaging, of course. And we're looking at things like biochar and hydrochar, which you use for like soil remediation to help plants grow and to enrich the soil and to like lock in carbon. And then you have activated carbon as well, which you'll find in pretty much everything, all the filtration materials that you'll ever use. So your Brita filters use this, water commission, or at least your general country pipelines use this to filter out all like the heavy metals and the PFAS chemicals and the sediments. And even oil and gas companies use this as well to purify their emissions, essentially.
So the seaweed industry is full of potential, and to me too, the economic projection is huge because I was even doing a little research, anticipating our conversation, and I'm realizing a lot of money is being pumped into seaweed. I mean, Jeff Bezos's Earth Fund awarded like $100 million, and this is not Jamaican dollars, obviously. $100 million to study and develop seaweed, especially for the potential that it has to trap carbon dioxide. You know, that's basically key cause of contributor to climate change. But even looking at some of the byproducts that you just spoke about locally, in the area of sustainability, these are the alternatives that we'd want. So like, why is no one really talking about seaweed in Jamaica? Like, are you the only organization that's now looking at seaweed farming in Jamaica?
Yes, to the degree, I guess, of our establishment. So historically, what we've been used to is like wildcraft harvesting, which is very dangerous. And that looks like...
What's that? Sound like a video game.
Yeah.
About Warcraft? I don't know.
I mean, it might as well be. But like people go out into the rough seas and they dive for seaweed. And so they pick it up and they bring it back and they sell it. That's usually how people, at least are aware of seaweed products or just the seaweed itself to buy on the street side or even in some supermarkets. But it's extremely dangerous. Like, people dive for
it. How so? So how is it different from your method? Is it that it's an unsustainable way of doing it as well, like where they're taking from and not... Like it's not regenerative?
Yes, that is typically the case. So what usually happens is that if you're not like an experienced like diver or you're not in the space as like a seaweed diver of sorts, what you'll do is end up taking most of like the catch itself or what is being grown, and so that doesn't leave any more to rejuvenate and even to be cultured further. And so in those ways, that is how it's unsustainable. What we're doing, though, is we're culturing them and we're preparing them to be cultured for harvest. So we have our own setups, we have our apparatuses, and we lay the seaweed out. We monitor them over like the period of 6 weeks. And then at harvesting periods, then we take up most of the produce, like, and we leave maybe a third of it left for it to grow again.
Okay. So like, what's a seaweed harvest like? You know, like how is it, like the metric, is it like tons or pounds? Like how many, what's like a good quantity to harvest?
Typically in the tons is what like the market is looking for. They need like a very streamlined and constant supply of seaweed because mm-hmm. that is what is in a lot of the value added products and the byproducts that I'd mentioned before. But so far we've been able to do just like pounds at a time. Right. And it's only this year that we've had the capacity with additional resources that we are able to, at least projectingly, are supposed to be hitting the tons target. And so that's where we're going.
So what I wanted to find out, at the risk of like, we're all good here, Global Yadi family. So I don't think it's because you spoke about Perda Larceny, but I mean, where's the seaweed farm? Is it just in one location that you're doing farming? You know, which coast or which side of Jamaica are you tapping into at the moment?
Yeah, so we're right now, without giving out specific locations, we're in Portland and St. Mary and St. Abbey. Like those are the spots that we're hitting up right now.
How do you ensure the security of your seaweed farm, seeing that it's in the ocean, really? Is it in the ocean?
Yeah. Yes, it definitely is in the ocean. The way how we secure our seaweed, at least right now, is relying on people. So that's pretty much having people go out on boats and just kind of monitor the area. In some cases. What we're trying to move towards for this year is to include a lot of automation. So we'll have like drones and we'll have cameras set up just to ensure that, one, of course, we monitor, you know, potential theft and predial larceny.
Yeah.
But two, we also need to at least asynchronously monitor the growth rates. We want to understand what's going on in the water and by extension, understand the variables that are at play for us to even expect different growth rates, if at all.
Mm, yeah, definitely. So you mentioned that, well, I understand that sargassum for you is like at the research stage now, but in terms of what types of seaweed are you actually cultivating at this point?
Yeah, so it's the broad category of sea moss. And so they come in two specific strains and then you have sub-strains beyond that, but they're called Gracilaria and Euchema. And so you'll find that naturally occurring all over Jamaica, or at least in the most suspect spots. And then, of course, you have sargassum, but then you have like a sub-strain of sargassum that typically shows up on the Jamaican waters.
Right. And you know how in the way when we talk about flora and fauna that you have endemic species, are those things applicable to seaweed or?
Yes. Right. To some degree. There are stories coming back from like the 1980s and 1990s about a particular strain of seaweed being migrated from like one part of the world to then bring to the Jamaican waters. But outside of that, they're like naturally occurring for us.
Oh, interesting. So you spoke a little bit about job opportunities, you know, within seaweed farming and a little bit about engaging fisher folk. And so where I understand that Key Farms is doing work in the research aspect and setting up policy, what is it like engaging? So tell us about the work in the local community. Is it just fisher folk that you've been engaging so far? And even so, what has been the response or what are the nature of the activities that you're doing with the fisher folk?
Yeah, so it's mainly fisher folk thus far. We do have engagements, or at least anticipated engagements, with youth in the agricultural science space, like CASE, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But the engagement thus far has mainly been with fisher folk. So a typical day would look like part of the team going out to maybe a specific dive site, and we just happen to see fishermen there who are actively looking for fish, or they happen to be looking for sea moss or different types of seaweed to sell. And so we either go there and dive with them, and so we engage with them afterwards to then onboard them informally, and to just inform them about what it is and sensitize them about what it is that we're trying to do. And so that usually is the pull-o. The harder parts or the harder bits come in the form of us like charting out protocol as to how to train them properly, to know what to expect, to identify potential different markets so that they can actually sell to, and for us as well, so that we can ensure that there's a streamline of not just the biomass itself, but also markets and demand for them to be bought out. So essentially, at the end of each harvest cycle, they should be able to sell the seaweed and make a profit, so that they don't necessarily have to solely rely on regular fishing to, right, you know, maintain their incomes.
Yeah, and we even know that with climate change too, the fishing industry is also impacted sometimes as it relates to the temperatures changing and, you know, the availability of fish stock. So it's really timely and a very great intervention that the fisher folk are being introduced to a more structured way of, you know, pursuing alternative livelihoods. Why did I have to make that sound so complicated? Yeah, it's a good thing that they have something else to, you know, another alternative economically. And you mentioned that it's kind of hard, you know, establishing, like, you know, how is it that you'll go about, you know, bringing them in? Is it because for fisher folk, it's kind of more informal, like all their lives they've been fishing, this is what they do. So now you're bringing them over to seaweed farming, you know, you want to regulate, but, you know, probably they feel like, oh, we know the sea, we can die without you. Is it that kind of thing?
It's a little bit of that. The responses have been mixed. Right. Grant, we tend to, at least on the fishermen or fisher folk side, we tend to interact with fisher folk who are men who happen to be older. And typically, the at least switching them over, at least introducing them to change, can be a mixed bag. Like, some are for it, some are against it. But one thing for sure and for certain is that thematically, what tends to come up is that they want to be independent.
Yeah.
So we accommodate that, or at least we're trying to accommodate that in a unique way, whereby we have them a part of the network, and so they can feel like they own part of their own operations to be able to freely grow things and then sell it either back to the public or to us at different price points, so that they can receive consistent sources of revenue.
Right. I like that. So another thing that I wanted to ask you, what's the plan, or what have you been doing when you harvest the seaweed? Is it a matter of selling it locally, selling it internationally? So I understand, of course, that you're trying to eke out an avenue for the fisher folk to benefit. And because you mentioned too that it's mainly, you know, it's a lot of male fishers, well, out at sea at least. Some fisher folk also include the women who sell fish. But now that there is an opportunity to use seaweed to develop other products, is this another era that you're tapping into, or where is this going?
Yeah, for sure. Locally, we haven't been able to tap in to the core systematic local market. Like, we know for sure that
core systematic local market, Nicholas?
So, like, the heavy hitters, the heavy players. So think you biscuit companies, think you food and beverage companies. So like Nestle, Jamaica, for instance, or even Seprod as another example, or True Juice.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to tap into them just yet. We've mainly been able to kind of sell artisanally. So on the roadside or to other like people who actually sell sea moss. And so that's where we are right now. The next stage, though, hopefully for this year, is when we'll be able to probably get into those local markets, those systematic quote-unquote markets, so like the Tokus and the Nestle, Jamaica, and Seprod, then move beyond that to hit some of the more international players. So, like, you know, like the Nestle overseas, or even L'Oreal, or some, or even Tesla for packaging, or some other company that uses seaweed, and a lot of them do use seaweed.
Right. It's really good, of course, obviously, that you're thinking those companies, because we do know that you have to consider the economic viability. Right. But I saw, so while you were explaining that, I'm seeing how there can also be a lot of opportunity for the local economy, and also even small and micro entrepreneurs as well, because even though you mentioned that while you have some engagement with artisanal artisanal community, there's also an opportunity, you know, for other community-based organizations or groups, you know, to say, what can we do with seaweed or sea moss? But I understand too that that may also depend on the awareness and sensitization efforts that may be needed to, like, have people understand what are the benefits of seaweed, not just economic benefits, but nutritionally, and the other possibilities of how they can use it as part of, you know, lifestyle products and offerings. Because, I mean, if Jamaicans fully understand and buy into that, then there's no limit to, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they're going to want to be using those things in their products, whether it's food or otherwise. So, but I do, at the end of the day, I'm guessing it also is depending on what is your focus area. So, in terms of the international market that you plan to tap into, I know there's a time we were exploring, as you were mentioning, something about carbon capture potential and the biofuel and all of those things. So what's the outlook for the international space where Key Farms is concerned?
Yeah, so first and foremost, and I guess we've accidentally been cornered into this case. So we're first and foremost ecosystem builders, and that looks like covering all the various ecosystem services related to having entire blue economy and the mariculture industry grow. We, based on how things are set up now, because of just like the lack of infrastructure, we are truly unable to capitalize fully on the opportunities within the blue economy space, unless we cater to the foundations first. And so that's where our focus is right now.
I love that. Topics,
yeah. The topic can come later, but like we're...
No, it's because I'm itching to use it, and I know I'm at the risk of sounding corny, because I'm like, you don't want to dive in and drown in seaweed farming. So I get it. So what you're saying is that this is Jamaica, and this is seaweed farming. So this is new, you know, in this kind of market space. So the policy infrastructure, the economic the infrastructure is not yet there, you know, for you to just take off like that. So I love that, you know, there's so many dimensions into what Key Farms is doing. So you're engaging fisher folks, so you're tapping into that capacity building and, you know, livelihood diversification aspect, you know, for that group and population. And then, as you just mentioned, that there are certain things setting the foundation. So talk to us about setting the foundation and what's the support like, because like I said, even though it's new and you have to be doing the foundation setting, what's the support like locally from the government, from the private sector in this aspect?
Or
collaboration, maybe it's not like, so what's that dynamic like now?
The support, based on the need, or the need for even getting things off the ground, there's not more support locally. So you tend to find that a lot of my engagements with funders, more often than not, are
international.
They are right. They have the money, and so a lot of the work that I have to be doing is convincing them that one, Jamaica is not in Africa, and two, the Caribbean is here, and that there is three, you know, opportunities within the Caribbean space. It just needs like some resources and a spark to ignite the entire flame, and so I'm trying to position ourselves and trying to push the narrative that we are here to not just build for the sake of profits and for the sake of just growing seaweed and developing things along the value chain, but we're here to build the entire ecosystem and grow with it as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. And do understand the importance of you needing to massage that process. But I also want to learn more about the side that you alluded to. So outside of the economic things, because trust me, I've seen you. I've been following Key Farms and pitch competitions. You know, we ran into each other at COP28, you working the room, and also using the opportunity to share your experience, you know, because you're still, you know, on the youth platform as well. And this is an area that young people are interested in, even if it's not seaweed farming, but tapping into funding, access to financing, and you know, sustainable access to financing. And it's like a moving goalpost, you know, creating these structures and trying to secure viable or sustainable investments and, you know, impact investments for what you're building out. And I feel like it's almost a paradox, because people are pursuing youth for their innovation and their talent, and you're encouraging them to think of ideas. And, you know, when you roll out something like this, it's still kind of a struggle to get the traction and the support that's needed. But you mentioned too that you spend a lot of time around the research, around the policy. And are those things also important for when you get the funding or for how you pitch for funding?
Yes, because the climate change space is very much an unforgiving space. Like, you getting something right within the climate change space could mean the death of either your project or your innovation or the thing that you're trying to do. At least the social sphere within the industry is very rigid. And I guess to some degree it's understandable, because historically we are known for just like destroying the planet as humans. And so our aims now, at least the industry's aims now, is to try to get everything right. And so if there's any slip up or any mistake, it can be detrimental. So so involving ourselves in all of the policy work, ensuring that we have our procedures and protocols right, and ensuring that we have the research and development properly documented and processed, is quite literally important to the survival of everything that we're doing.
So when you say research, what is it that you guys need to be establishing? And when you talk about policy, what are the policy areas that are important for this industry? Maybe start with research, yeah.
Yeah, from the research side, if you can think of just basic things on the side of like biodiversity as an example, we can't just throw the seaweed and expect it not to impact the ecosystem itself. We have to look at things like carrying capacity, meaning, you know, how much nutrients we can actually take from a particular waterway without it being impacting like fish and other species of flora and fauna. We have to look at things like a biodiversity index to understand how the seaweed that we're growing in a particular area increases or decreases the likelihood of fish being able to spawn and grow into adult fish, or even the effects of our seaweed growth and mariculture activities on the growth of like other ecosystem builders, like coral reef, for instance. We have to look at how the carbon itself is being trapped and captured within the seaweed. We need to understand how it is either being released at different times. We need to understand how this plays into the entire carbon cycle, with respect to it being sunken, you know, the bits and pieces that are like removed from herbivory from the seaweed itself, how it sinks to the sea, sinks to the bottom of the sea, and how that affects things like carbon redox, and how that affects our entire life cycle assessment for understanding what it is that we're doing and how that affects the entire ecosystem. So those are like some of the heavier variables that we have to account for. On the policy side now, we have to look at...
Because, I mean, it's a lot to take in a very good way. But I really wanted to ask, before we go to the policy, the research areas that you just mentioned, are is this new research for where Jamaica is concerned?
A lot of it is new. The Caribbean is lacking in quantifiable data.
Oh, we're and tired so of that.
Yeah,
it's. So what it has you been researching in the Caribbean? It's always about the lack. Everybody's always learning the lack of data in any field, really, where the Caribbean. Yeah. But kudos to people who are doing work in other spaces, and I'm really happy that you're now taking on the mantle of pioneering. This initiative and also the commitment you've now given, because it's not about you getting in to just make some money and, to make greens off the blue economy. So I'm really appreciating the depth of this conversation, because a lot goes into creating that enabling environment for the eco-viability. And I've been tying with that word, before, so... for it to be economically viable in the future, but even from an eco-friendly standpoint, we have to consider that. So are these local researchers as well that you've been working with? Is it your team, the Key Farm Seal, that's carrying out the research?
Yeah, so we're carrying out the research. We're getting support from either other scholars who have come on board to just assist. And we actually work with a lot of the... a lot of the government agencies on establishing a lot of the data sets as the source of truth that we can collectively share. And so that is what we've been doing. It has not been here before because a lot of the data that has been pretty much collected, we're not good in the Caribbean at quantifying a lot of things. And so the data that we have thus far is based on stories and anecdotes. That's a lot of the things that we're finding at the macro level,
right?
Great.
And I guess now this is very useful what is happening in real time, because the research that you're doing, you're able to feed that into the policy formulation, and you're also able to feed that into your international platforms, when you're pitching for funding, when you're showcasing, so the empirical evidence is accruing.
And beyond that, most important, we can use that data to model how valuable the Caribbean actually is to the entire ecosystem.
What that mean? What does that mean?
For sure, you probably know this. The Caribbean has been undersold to the masses. And we, by extension, haven't been able to assess how valuable our natural or nature-based assets are to the survival of our entire human race. So you'll find that a lot of the things that we're looking at, we can use them to understand how economically viable keeping things like coral reef alive in the Caribbean is very, how important that is. And, removing or at least keeping the mangroves safe, understanding how important that is to then truly assess the value of land masses or different areas or different industries within the Caribbean. So this... collecting this data and assessing this data and analyzing this data properly is truly important to really boost our entire GDP potentially by even introducing a big and macroeconomic driver such as the blue economy into the scope of things.
Wow, that's huge. That's just all I can say. So now that's the research side of things. Now you are going to go on to the policy development, because I know, like you said, you and I were having a conversation the other day, and this massive potential for carbon capture and how we can tap into it through seaweed farming. But you were saying the policy infrastructure needs to be there. So what's happening in that space?
Yeah. So we, as I guess an independent body by right, shouldn't be able to sell carbon credits based on. We have the ability naturally to accrue carbon credits based on our activities, right? So the seaweed, it captures and sequesters 20 times more carbon than any tree. So does the other activities that we basically embark upon. The problem is that we can't sell these same activities or the carbon credits that come out of this to the international markets, like the heavy emitters or even are those that need to purchase carbon credits for removal purposes. We can't sell them. We can't sell them at all because we in Jamaica and by extension in the Caribbean don't have the policy framework to even provide those services. So in essence, you need like a broker in order to sell these carbon credits, and the broker is always the country government.
Yeah. Could you explain maybe to our listeners who may not understand how carbon credits work or what are carbon credits so that, you know, we really see how impactful this can be for the seaweed farming?
For sure. So one carbon credit is equivalent to one carbon ton that is removed from the environment and trapped within the environment. So in our case, if we are able to like harvest X amount of seaweed or X amount of seaweed over a period of time, amounting to maybe a ton or more, we can make the claim that the carbon that is trapped within the seaweed itself, based on the chemical makeup, the biochemical makeup, we're able to claim that close to like a 1 ton of carbon is trapped within that biomass. And if we take that biomass and turn it into things like biochar, for instance, and then use that biochar in the soil, it counts as a carbon credit. Like one carbon credit is equal to a ton of that equivalence. So one carbon credit that is trapped, or at least one carbon ton that is removed from the environment and trapped within the soil, to like the value, or at least to the timeline of like 2,000 years, for instance, counts as one carbon credit.
Go ahead.
No. Yeah. So pretty much, you know, we should have the capacity to remove like close to 2 million tons of carbon from the environment in probably about 2 to 5 years, depending on how fast we move.
And this is key farm, seaweed farming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What I also want to understand too is what's the value exchange of selling the carbon credits outside of Jamaica?
Yeah. So based on the classification of our carbon credits, we by right should be able to sell it at a high premium to the tune of $500 to $5,000 per carbon ton.
So this is essentially us getting paid for doing this ecosystem service.
Right. To potentially billions of US dollars.
Okay. So does that mean the government is clamoring to support key farms because of what this also means for, you know, our NDC targets and contributions and, you know, us being on the front line of not just climate vulnerability, but, you know, climate action as a region. Mm. So do they, and when I say the, you know, yeah, maybe government, do they fully understand the work that Key Farms is doing? What's the reception and collaboration like in terms of how they are also trying to accelerate your efforts to protect biodiversity?
So they're in support, for sure in support. I think where they fall short is that they probably don't have the capacity. And so in those ways...
Capacity
that is where,
for what?
To quite literally do things like build out the policies themselves, to write a lot of the white papers, the green papers, and to then get them passed in like Parliament, for instance. Like the capacity just isn't there. Like there aren't enough experts within the government to truly tackle a lot of the things that need to be tackled in order for us to take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of us.
So outside of government expertise, do we have the local expertise, though, to potentially do that?
To some degree. But what you find is that a lot of the local expertise is already swallowed by the Key Farms ecosystem.
Oh, so, understood.
Yeah.
So, well, that's encouraging to know that, you know, the government is and of course, not surprising to know that they'll be behind a kind of an effort such as this. But what does the private sector support look like? And I want to get into this because, you know, I see the ads, not with Key Farms, but, you know, like, I always want to know, is it optics or is it really impact? What has the private, because a lot of times people, it's easy for people to wrap their minds around environment efforts like, you know, beach cleanups and tree plantings. And you see the corporate companies, you know, outing their numbers, whether it's through their foundations or whether it's through, you know, sponsoring different community groups or schools or doing something. But have they been stepping up to the plate or, you know, have you identified or been managed to, has somebody latched on to Key Farms to say, we believe in you. We want to be one of the first, you know, like how they would boast, you know, like what a particular sponsor. I don't want to call their names because I'm not trying to call them out for this. Like where they're like proud sponsor of Usain Bolt since 2004. So who is saying proud sponsors of Key Farms since you got out the gate? What's the private sector reception like?
It is very low to non-existent.
They don't know about you guys.
they know, but it's not the sexiest sell. It's not the sexiest sell at all. And so mariculture overall is still kind of lagging behind in terms of just public reception or just sensitization as to what truly is happening within the space. And beyond that, if we're being real, a lot of the environmental efforts related and climate change efforts related to Jamaica coming from, the private sector, they tend to end up in the greenwashing thematic areas. And you find that they like the idea of environmental conservation, but the true gory practice of it is a different story. So you're not really seeing a lot of true private sector support, not just for us, but for a lot of the projects that are already out in the space.
Right. But, you know, we know how it is sometimes. It's like that domino effect where maybe when you get snagged by some international company or otherwise that sees and believes, and then you pick up that traction. And I'm not saying that this should be how it goes, but we know that that's how it goes sometimes. It takes a little bit much more massaging for people to get that buy-in. But I really, really am proud of the work that's unfolding, you know, locally to see that kind of the pioneering that's happening through Key Farms and, you know, opening the door to a whole new industry for us and tapping into the multi-layered potential of the blue economy for Jamaica, for coastal communities. It's really encouraging to see. And of course, as a beacon of hope for youth, because the points of reference that a lot of young people have when they see their peers in the climate space, a lot of persons, they have, like, whether it's NGOs or other organizations doing community impact projects and volunteer work, but at least from a Caribbean context, not many, you know, have this kind of structured format in terms of what you're doing. So we know that the economic viability is down the line for you, but, you know, the kind of deliberate build out that's happening for, you know, a prospective eco business that has a multiplicity. Why am I using these fancy words? A wealth of benefits, a sea of benefits. It's really encouraging to see. And I'm really hoping a lot of young people are looking on. And I think it gives them encouragement, you know, for the science experts that are there, the persons who are interested, the experts in policy or the people who may be interested in shaping policy, they now see how the skills that they want to develop can be applied, you know, to give support to efforts like this. So that's truly amazing. So as we wind down, I think we've covered really a lot of great things that Key Farms, you know, that you're up to. And I really, you know, I saw you guys at Denby last year. So Denby is Jamaica's largest agricultural show. So, I mean, getting out there, there was something that I came wanting to try. What were you guys handing out at Denby? Was it some smoothie?
It was like a sea moss drink. So we had variations of like strawberry, blueberry, and like strong back. So that is, we were just trying to sensitize people about the potential of CMOS and so why, you know, grow it and get into the space broadly.
Well, we're going to have a round two or something over CMOS drinks or something that we find a way to share with the global Yadi audience. Have you transformed your lifestyle now that you're a seaweed farmer? And when I say transform, meaning like, you know, like how I'm trying to be fit by going to the gym. So I'm now drinking protein shakes and so forth. So like with you, with a seaweed farm, are you eating more seaweed? Are you like, you know, experimenting with the beverages, not just that? At Expo's giving it away, but what have you been doing with seaweed on a personal level?
Admittedly, I have not been doing much.
Oh my.
And that is not intentional. The plan is to really get more intentional about having my own products. But a lot of the time, because, you know, we focus mainly on B2B, either sales or just community impact work, we don't really get to have our own supply. Right. Yeah. But hopefully soon. This year for sure.
Wow. How altruistic. So you're definitely out there cultivating and creating opportunities for the greater good. So I really love that. Nicholas, it's a pleasure. It was a pleasure having you, you know, sharing all that you have done or continue to do through Key Farms. And I do know that, you know, you're so much more than Key Farms, you know, still in the tech space. You're still in the tech space. Right? Like, what are you up to outside of Key Farms too? Like, what have you
been? Yeah, outside of Key Farms, I'm on a few company boards. I'm involved in tech in that regard. Like, right. I'll be on a few company boards. I'll still do a lot of human rights work outside of this, still within the philanthropic space broadly. I do tend to tinker somewhat on either ideas that I could probably flesh out within tech or opportunities that I kind of want to deep dive into. And so I'll have like a small side quest here and there. I'll either build out something from scratch or just like round up some of my friends within tech and finance, and we'll build something out over a weekend or a few days. But majority of my time, probably 95 to 98% of my time is like dedicated towards the farm and to ensuring that we're getting somewhere and making as much impact as possible.
Absolutely amazing. So impressive. So let us know too, like, how can we connect outside of the podcast or people listening? How can they connect with you or Key Farms to, you know, kind of follow up and support the work that you've been doing or even learn more from what's happening?
Yeah, you can connect with me personally. It's on Instagram is like nicholas.key. I think on Twitter it's Key Nicholas. It's just my last name, then my first name. And Key Farms generally, it's the social media handles are Key Farms HQ. And then if you want to reach out to us, it's info@keyfarms.com and the website keyfarms.com.
All right. So we're expecting such great things from Key Farms. And, you know, we are 100% behind what you've been doing, and we wish you the best. And when we say wish you, I mean you and the team collectively the best in all that you all set out to do going forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Yadi Podcast. Follow us at Global Yadi on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and X. Subscribe to our YouTube channel or wherever you listen to this podcast at Global Yadi, YAADIE.